I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views. Within Western media, Vladimir Putin and Russia are often treated as interchangeable. But what if we thought about Russia beyond Putin? That is the goal of Tony Wood in his new book, Russia Without Putin: Money, Power, and the Myths of the New Cold War. Tony joins us on this edition of the program to take a look at Russia beyond the image of Putin. In particular, we turn our attention to how Russia's transformation from the Soviet system to neoliberal capitalism has led to the point Russia is at today with Vladimir Putin. In addition, we also talk about Boris Yeltsin, Russian foreign policy, and much, much more. With that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Tony Wood, author of Russia Without Putin: Money, Power, and the Myths of the New Cold War. Welcome to Parallax Views. Tony Wood, author of Russia Without Putin, a very interesting title that I am very excited to speak about. How are you doing today, Tony?
Good, thanks. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Russia has been on a lot of people's minds the past few years, and especially Vladimir Putin. But before we get into your latest book, I wanted to ask you, how did you get into looking at Russia as a nation state? I know you have a previous book, Chechnya, The Case for Independence. Maybe we could talk about that and how you became interested in examining Russia.
Sure. Yeah, happy to talk about that. My interest in Russia really came when I was at school. I was lucky enough to study Russian language and literature in school, that is high school in the UK, where I grew up. And I spent time in Russia as part of that. We were able to visit, this was in 1993 was my first trip to Russia as part of a school language program. And I went again in 1995 and spent a couple of months there. And then I went to college and studied Russian, Russian and French, but as part of the college degree, I also got to spend an entire academic year in Russia, and that was 97-98. And so that combination of experiences is really what drove my interest in Russia, and it's a very particular phase in Russia's recent history. The 90s are a very turbulent, difficult decade for most ordinary Russians, a time of extraordinary optimism for some people, but also extraordinary suffering for a lot of ordinary people too. And I think that's something that often gets left out of a lot of accounts. And that was part of my motivation in writing about Russia, is to try and balance the picture a bit better. And really, while I was in Russia in the mid-90s, that was when Russia was fighting this counterinsurgency war against the Chechen independence movement. The war was launched in 1994, fought to a stalemate in 96, and then restarted by Putin in 1999. And there was a kind of pacification reached around 2004, although the insurgency has continued in low-level form ever since. And really, my conviction at that point was that you can't really understand modern Russia without understanding Chechnya. For me, this would be like writing about the US in the 60s and 70s without even mentioning Vietnam, right? So that was the motivation for the first book, was that Chechnya is really central to understanding what Russia is. And also, that Chechnya needs to be understood on its own terms, not purely in the terms in which the Russians have depicted them. And again, I would make the comparison with Vietnam. In many ways, that war was essential to the formation of modern contemporary Russia, as Vietnam was for 70s America. So yeah, I hope that makes sense as where the books came from.
Well, I'm glad you gave that background, because I feel like a lot of times when there's commentary on Russia in the media, I see a really disturbing trend of just oversimplification. I was reading a piece in the New York Times last week, an op-ed that referred to the Bolshevik DNA that's in Russia. And I was like, these are really off-putting metaphors. And it seems like we've never gotten past sort of the Cold War paranoid Red Scare image of Russia.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very present in, especially in US and Western European relationships to Russia. There is an element of the Cold War mindset. And I think, I mean, I do mention this very briefly in the book, but I think there are other scholars and writers who've worked on this a lot more. And this is an interesting fact. I think that in some ways, since the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, really since then, neither the USSR nor post-Soviet Russia have been perceived as fully legitimate players on the world stage, right? So post-Soviet Russian governments have been perceived as legitimate to the extent that they do what the West wants them to. And the minute they don't, they're slotted back into this, you know, bad Bolshevik archetype, right? And so hence, you know, Yeltsin was very warmly received because he was essentially doing what Western governments wanted him to do. And Putin, I have many criticisms of Putin, which we can go into further on in the podcast, but it is a fact that he is less willing to bend the Russian state's agenda to suit the West. And that has really been the driver of him being, of contemporary Russia being put into this very Cold War frame. I will say also that there is an even longer history going back before the Cold War of perceiving Russia as the kind of negative archetype for everything that Western civilization is not.
Can I add something to that really briefly? One area that I've been interested in, I think there's a lot of, and I don't know if this was the direction you were going in, but there's a lot of racism directed at a lot of examinations of Russia by the West, anti-Semitic tropes like the Judeo-Bolshevik conspiracy. But I'm sorry for interrupting you. I should have let you finish.
No, it's okay. I mean, I think, yeah, I guess I wouldn't quite categorize it as racism in the Russian case, but it does have a very similar structure. And it is a form of a very kind of crude essentialization, you could put it that way, of a national group. And it does, you're right, absolutely, it does play on these sort of very strong anti-Semitic tropes, the kind of red baiting. But it does also go back further, right, to the 19th century even, that, and especially in the US, there was this idea of, you know, the US being this realm of freedom and Russia being this realm of persistent oppression and slavery, which is ironic because there's actually a lot of interesting thinking to be done, I think, in comparing the history of the US Civil War and the end of chattel slavery in the US and the emancipation of the serfs in Russia, which happened around the same time. So there's a lot more similarities between the two countries, given the very large differences. And I think there is something there about seeing oneself in the mirror rather than seeing the country as it is, especially in US attitudes to Russia.
Now, with regards to Russia without Putin, I like the title there. Maybe you could explain that for my listeners that are unfamiliar.
Sure. So the title itself is actually a slogan that came up in, there was the cycle of protests in 2011, 2012. There were initially protests against election rigging by the ruling party in Russia, and then they turned into protests against Putin's return to the presidency in the spring of 2012. And so a lot of the protesters took up the slogan, Russia without Putin. In the book, I make this clear that I'm in no way calling for regime change. That's not my interest at all. I was thinking of Russia without Putin as more an analytic challenge, that this book is really aimed very much at a Western audience. And the challenge for me is that people need to be able to see that even though Putin is very central to modern Russia, and power is certainly very centralized, and the personality of the ruler at the center of that system is important. Nonetheless, the focus on the personality of Putin and his personal preferences is excessive. It's very reductive, and I think counterproductive, if you like. It narrows the focus on Russia to the whims of this one man, and I think really prevents us from understanding the country as it is and how that power system functions, how Russia is ruled, and for whose benefit. And I think we need to get beyond Putin, if you like. So that was the force of the title. It was really as a sort of analytic challenge rather than my recommendation for how Russia should be.
Is there a reason that a lot of Western reporting and sort of Western thought on Russia is sort of stuck in that mindset of, you know, Russia is Putin, Putin is Russia? What do you think is behind that?
This is a good question. I think there are several things going on. One of them is related to just a general loss of overall expertise on Russia since the end of the Cold War. In the US, certainly, the amount of funding directed to college programs and language programs is massively decreased. So we're just getting a much smaller number of people with training on Russia and in Russia emerging and being able to write about it. That's one aspect of it. So the just diminishing information means that people grab hold of individuals as the explanation for stories, rather than looking at the wider structures of which those individuals are part. But I think this is also a broader trend in journalism and analysis of global politics, to be honest. There's a very strong focus on individual strongmen. And this is true of Brazil, this is true of India, this is true of the Philippines, and by the way, also true of the US, right? That there's a very strong focus on Trump, as if understanding Trump allows you to understand everything about the US, ditto Bolsonaro's Brazil, right? Each country is now described as if it's the possession of this one man, right?
Bolsonaro's Duterte Brazil. Duterte in the Philippines.
Absolutely, yeah. Duterte, there's Erdogan in Turkey, Modi's India, all of these things. It's like, and I think there is, I don't think there's sufficient acknowledgement really in the media of the extent to which the media itself is complicit in producing this image of the strongman, which it then criticizes.
Well, I was going to add to that, one of the interesting insights that you get into really early in the book is the fact that, as you mentioned, even during, you know, say the Reagan years, you know, when we had these movies like Red Dawn, which were, you know, full like Russia baiting, right? And sort of scaremongering about Russia. Even while that was going on, as you point out, there was funding at the university level for Russian studies. What's odd is it seems like after the fall of the Soviet Union, there's paradoxically less understanding of Russia, even though there's more freedom of movement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something Russian friends have remarked to me as well, that in a way, Russians are much more able to travel to the West as well, and Westerners much more able to travel. There's much more accessibility. There's many more different sources of information as well. And yet, despite all of that, there's much of Russian experience day to day and what the country is like that remains totally opaque to the outside world. And I think, again, like, journalists have to recognize some of their complicity in that and the failure to kind of to properly describe what they're looking at. And I do think that the obsession with Putin and Kremlin politics does play a role. I mean, the other thing I would say, it's not just, I forgot to mention earlier, there's not just the production of experts in US colleges and degree programs or whatever, what have you. But one noticeable thing, in the research I was doing for this book and other projects, is that Western governments also put large amounts of money into translating things written in Russian, right? That it was worth people in the West knowing what the Russians were writing about themselves. And I think that is also a major component of knowledge that the Cold War, for all the wrong reasons, generated, but that has also not totally disappeared, but is much diminished. And that part of the exchange is also really important. And the lack of that perspective does mean that that there's a diminished capacity from Western writers and analysts to even read what Russians are writing about themselves. And I think that that's much neglected.
You know, I want to get into the personality of Putin more and how you approach that in the book. But one more thing as a precursor to all of that, since we were talking about U.S. journalism looking at sort of individuals like Duterte or Trump or Putin even, do you think part of that may be an outcome? I don't like throwing around the term neoliberalism, but maybe it's an outcome of this sort of directional move to look at things in terms of individuals rather than structures.
Yeah, no, I think you're definitely onto something there. I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, one would have to think about what the mechanisms are for that transformation. That would be really interesting to think about. But yeah, there's definitely something in there where the whole kind of apparatus for thinking about the contemporary world is very geared to individual agents and their responsibility for what's happening, and much less attention. Well, I would say much less attention to structures up until recently. I would say the last few years, there's definitely been an increasing, I mean, I would arguably since Occupy really, or even the 2008 financial crisis, much more interest in and attention to structure in the domestic context. And so, you know, everyone knows what the 1% are, right? And all of these things are much clearer analytically in the domestic context. But I think that awareness of structure hasn't really been translated onto the international stage, maybe.
Now, this is just setting the groundwork for discussing Putin. How would you summarize the sort of Western interpretation of Putin? What are the main components of it? I think people look at Putin as a sort of villainous character, but what are the components of that sort of Western understanding of Putin? Like, what are the essentials of it?
So I think, I guess the main component of it is that Putin is a man made by the Soviet system, right? That he is made by it, and specifically by the security apparatus of the Soviet system, and therefore he is loyal to it, more loyal to that even than anything else. So he is a graduate of, you know, the law school in St. Petersburg, and then went into the KGB and served in the KGB in East Germany, and then returned to Russia in the sort of turmoil of the early 90s, and then worked in the administration of his hometown, St. Petersburg, or it was Leningrad and then became St. Petersburg. So there's a lot of fixation on Putin as a loyal product of the KGB and how he's somehow over time been implementing some kind of revanchist kind of agenda to bring back the power of the security services. I would say that's the general mythological picture of Putin, if you like.
And I mean, what is your sort of view of Putin, I guess, in that regard? How would you respond to that vision of Putin that is usually given in Western media outlets?
I mean, I guess two things I would say. One is that some of the facts on which that picture is based, or other, the facts themselves are not wrong. You know, he is a product of the Soviet era, but then so was Boris Yeltsin. And so was Mikhail Gorbachev, and so are a lot of other politicians who don't have the same connotations as Putin does. So there's something there to be explained, that there's nothing that makes Putin more sinister by virtue of being Soviet relative to other people. And I think there's also a lot of emphasis on the Soviet period as being formative for Putin, and somehow that he's already made as a character, as the character we see now, if you like, from, you know, the end of the 80s onwards. And my emphasis is really that in terms of the kind of politician Putin is and the way he has run this system that he inherited, I think the 90s were actually much more formative for him than the Soviet period, arguably. That certainly the Soviet period gave him a certain kind of disposition, a certain way of viewing things, but in terms of the practice of rulership, the way he governs, what he thinks the state should do, and its relationship to business and its relationship to the whole phenomenon of corruption, all of that is really formed in the 1990s and in post-communist Russia and in capitalist Russia. So I would kind of flip the argument on its head that really Putin is not so much an archetypically Soviet man, he's actually an archetypal man of the Russian 90s.
I guess in regards to the Soviet Union, what influence, if any, do you think the Soviet Union had? No, I don't want to say just on Putin, but what is the lingering influence of the Soviet experience on Russia today? I mean, there's many aging Russians who still lived through the Soviet Union.
Yeah, it's enormous. I mean, you know, this was a system which was in place for most of the 20th century. And you go to any part of Russia today and most things you are looking at will have been built by that system, right? The whole physical environment is shaped by this. And this is very significant, like in terms of, you know, the way cities are laid out, the way residential patterns work, the way the health system works, all of these things are a lot of the kind of infrastructure of contemporary Russian life was built in the Soviet Union. And, you know, the last 30 years have obviously modified it a great deal and things have certainly changed in a number of ways. But I would say the foundations on which modern Russia is built are still those of the Soviet Union. And every Russian person, regardless of whether they were born before or after 1991, is very aware of that legacy, is very present in their lives, not just physically, but also socially and psychologically. A lot of the kind of social cues, a lot of the culture, a lot of the frame of reference that people have is still very much that of the Soviet Union. And so really, I think there is this perception in the West that, oh, the Soviet Union was over and everyone was very happy to have this new thing called Russia. And it's strange that there are these lingering holdovers, but it would be like, I just think that kind of instantaneous sort of social transformation is not possible in actual reality. It would be like trying to explain, I'm trying to think of a sort of decent parallel, but as someone who grew up in the UK, for example, it would be like someone in the earliest 20th century saying, what was the influence of the whole Victorian era, right? It would be very hard to answer that because it would just be so total. The weight of that upon the present is just very, very large. So I think that does play a role very much in the present I guess I would differentiate that from the way in which this is mostly described in the Western press as some kind of
continuation of the sort of Soviet system.
Yeah, some kind of just straightforward continuation, or some kind of just lingering kind of bad psychological holdover that people just need to shake off. I just think that's not how. I mean, and one interesting way of thinking about this, there's a regular feature in Western news reports every so often. Someone does an opinion poll in Russia, and they say who is the most significant, important historical figure, and usually, you know, Stalin comes out on top and Peter the Great comes out second or something like this. And the Western reporters are like, my God, isn't this awful? Everyone in Russia is still a Stalinist. I'm sure there are plenty of Stalinists still, but I think there's a way in which the reporting seems to be more bizarre than the poll, that actually Russians have an understanding that history is complicated. And that if you ask someone who is your favorite historical figure, that's one question. But if you say who is important, that can include the fact of, you know, the person being an awful tyrant who killed millions of people, but nonetheless are important in your modern history. And you have to be able to relate to that past in a way that is clear about both its incredibly tragic sides, as well as the fact that it was responsible for the shape of the country as people knew it in the, you know, 50s and 60s and onwards. So I just think there is a kind of complexity to that history that means it's very present in Russian life. And I think in some ways it's interesting to be having this conversation in the US where I am now, because, you know, there's a lot of conversation about these Confederate monuments and about the presence of racism in kind of the physical infrastructure, as well as in the forms of policing in the US. And I think there's a question here about the, in some ways, the presence of the past within the present day just doesn't seem so surprising.
Right. There's always specters haunting every nation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's the good way of putting it.
Well, in regards to understanding not only Putin, but Russia today, I guess what really interested me about the book was your way of talking about Boris Yeltsin, who precedes Putin, and Russia in the post-Soviet aftermath, because I often feel as if there's this triumphalism after the Cold War ends. There's, you know, Fukuyama talking about the end of history, and I feel like we don't think about Russia after the Soviet Union falls in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the, we talked earlier about the kind of stereotypical image of Putin, and I think one of the major components of the kind of the standard Western view of Russia today is that in the 1990s, everything was moving in the right direction towards kind of a modern liberal capitalist state. Yeltsin was in charge. He wasn't perfect, but nonetheless, broadly democratic. And then along comes Putin and overturns all of that and, you know, sets the clock back to the Soviet times and wants to roll back capitalism and free enterprise and restore some sort of planned economy. And I think just all of those things I think are wrong and need overturning. And the main reason I think for doing that is actually there is a great deal of institutional continuity between Yeltsin and Putin, that in some ways Yeltsin built the system that Putin then inherited and consolidated. And you can see that, you know, recently we've had this referendum on changes to the Russian constitution, which happened over several days last week and the week before. And undoubtedly large amounts of rigging, and this is a common feature of elections in Putin's Russia. But the previous constitution was passed in a referendum in Russia in 1993, and there was also tremendous amounts of rigging then. That was guaranteed, you know, and that has been largely validated by all kinds of not exactly of experts, not exactly hostile to Yeltsin, and ditto other elections in the 1990s. So the fact of electoral manipulation has been a constant of this system since its formation in the early 90s, but during the 1990s, criticism of that was somehow muted because things were moving in the right direction as far as the West was concerned. And what I want to emphasize is that actually, you know, the system we have now is the logical kind of progression, logical development of the system that Yeltsin built in the 1990s.
Now, it's interesting because I know I have a lot of younger listeners, some just going into the world of university and higher education, who really, they don't have the memory of Yeltsin or Russia being in the news when they were growing up because they were so young. So I know this probably sounds like a very basic question, but sort of who was Boris Yeltsin as a leader and what was the system he put in place in Russia?
Yeah, so Yeltsin, how to sum him up? I mean, he was himself a product of the Soviet system. He was a local Communist Party boss in his home region of Yekaterinburg, which is out in the Urals. And he sort of gained a reputation in the 1980s as something of a kind of man of the people within the Soviet system, but he was a sort of plain speaking party boss and he got promoted. But then as kind of Gorbachev's attempts to reform the USSR in the late 1980s gathered force. And then also there was this sort of spiraling economic crisis that eventually led to the fall of the Soviet Union. Yeltsin acquired national prominence as the kind of the voice of the democratic movement, if you like. And so in 1991, he was elected president of the Russian component of the USSR. I don't know if I need to sort of explain that a bit, but just for anyone who wasn't aware, the Soviet Union was made up of 15 federal republics, of which Russia was one, right? Russia was by far the largest, very much the largest in terms of area, but also population, but it was one of 15 components. And so Yeltsin becomes president of that Russian component, while Gorbachev remains leader of the USSR as a whole, right? And basically, the final days of the Soviet Union, we're talking sort of 1990 to 91, it's a very complicated, chaotic time, events moving very rapidly, really rising economic crisis in the country as a whole. But it's also marked by a very strong tension between Gorbachev and Yeltsin as these two kind of strong men, who is going to win out. And eventually Yeltsin, there comes a point sort of late in 1991, I guess, where Yeltsin makes a deal with a couple of other presidents to dissolve the Soviet Union. So, I mean, I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but essentially the important thing to bear in mind in terms of Yeltsin's kind of placed in history, if you like, is that he really played a key role in the dismantling of the Soviet Union and the emergence of Russia as an independent state from within that system. Now, Yeltsin was very much supported in all of these efforts by the West, who saw him as the voice of the democratic movement, but also as a force pushing for the collapse of the Soviet Union, right? So as president of Russia, Yeltsin wanted all of the powers that go with that, and that required the fall of Gorbachev and the end of the Soviet Union as a system. And so when Yeltsin becomes prime minister, president of an independent Russia, which is now not part of the Soviet Union, he gets a lot of Western diplomatic support. And this is really important because for a lot of the 90s, there was this perception in Russia that if we carry out the right kind of reforms, if we implement, you know, shock therapy, all kinds of capitalist sort of free market reforms, if we privatize a lot of things, then we will move towards being as prosperous as the West, right? That's the goal, is to become, and you know, at the time people use the phrase a normal country a lot. We will eventually become a normal country. And so Yeltsin, in the Russian mind, as well as in the West, is very much associated with this project of becoming like the West through capitalist transformation, right? If that makes sense.
Yeah, it completely does. Were you going to add anything to that?
Well, I was just going to say, in terms of the system he put in place, the if you like, the mythological version of this is that Yeltsin installed democracy and capitalism at the same time, right? Because these things inevitably go together, right? That's the mythological view. Whereas the picture I put in the book, and this is not just my picture, of course, it's other people, that the prime interest of Yeltsin was in installing capitalism, and democracy definitely came second. When democracy got in the way of that agenda, democracy was kind of pushed to one side. And so I mentioned the vote rigging that happened over the Constitution. Again, Yeltsin's re-election in 96 was also due to vote rigging in large part. And there were other interventions by the West in Russian elections, by the way, all kinds of meddling by, especially by the US and the Clinton administration.
Yeah, I think Yeltsin, there was an article I was reading earlier that Yeltsin asked for Clinton's help.
That's right. And there was actually, you know, Clinton pollsters were helping him out with his campaign and, you know, would arrive in Russia with suitcases full of money. I mean, there are all kinds of anecdotes doing the rounds about that. So that is part of Yeltsin's, if you like, historical role and persona, is to be the representative of this project of Western-supported capitalist transformation. And I maintain that really the capitalist transformation was a really important part, and the democracy bit, when it was compatible with that, was fine. When it wasn't compatible, it was put to one side. And I think, so in some ways, when we see, when there is this criticism of Putin for being, you know, non-democratic, I think we need to look again at Yeltsin and see, well, actually, look, this guy, his priority was not democracy either. And there is actually a lot more similarities or continuities between these two men than is often realized.
Well, the other thing that's interesting to me about that period, and I know you get into this in the book, and I want to sort of parse it out a little bit here, is the sort of acceptance of neoliberal capitalism in Russia and what effect that has. I mean, you mentioned shock therapy, and obviously it's a very messy situation, right? You have a whole social infrastructure under the Soviet Union, and you can't sort of just get rid of that overnight. How did this move, this transformation towards capitalism affect Russia and its people, their position in terms of class and status?
Yeah, this is a good question. I mean, I go into this a lot in the book. The effect was really profound. I mean, you have to imagine an economic recession that was much worse than the Great Depression in the US, and happened even more quickly, right? Really, really profound. And also tied in not just with an economic crisis in terms of a drop in economic output, say, or a massive loss of income and increases in unemployment, but actually also at the same time, a kind of huge deindustrialization, right? Like a lot of these factories which kept a whole town alive, it's not just that they had a bad year and made less money, they actually just shut down completely, right? So the sense that there was that this was not just a kind of economic crash, but that it was permanent. And a lot of these factories have not come back, right? So if you imagine something like the Great Depression crossed with, you know, what has happened in a lot of Rust Belt towns in the US, right? But in the Rust Belt, a lot of this has happened over the space of 20, 30 years, and in Russia happened in the space of 5, say, right? So there's that, those processes happening simultaneously. A lot of poverty was very widespread, massive unemployment or underemployment, and terrible health outcomes as well, right? There was actually a huge drop in life expectancy in Russia in the early 90s, I think. There was a huge debate about this in The Lancet, the medical magazine I'm sure people are aware of, but about the statistics for mortality in Russia massively going up. Partly, I think this was to do with just the massive stresses of transition, but some of it was also due to the kind of collapse of health infrastructure. And some of those consequences are still kind of going to be with us. You know, a lot of the Soviet health infrastructure in terms of dealing with various kinds of infectious diseases or other kind of chronic conditions, which, you know, by the way, not to say the Soviet health system was so wonderful, but it was certainly better than what happened in the 1990s. So we're having, I think there's a lot of longer term impacts as well as the immediate economic suffering that the 90s generated that I think Russians are still living with.
And is that sort of what you mean by shock therapy, in case my listeners are unfamiliar with that term?
Oh yeah. Well, the shock therapy, I guess, I mean, certainly it has those consequences. The general meaning of the term is to do with, rather than carrying out a gradual series of economic reforms to get from through a period of crisis, is that you just do everything at once, right? I mean, the term itself, you know, has a long lineage, and it was applied, you know, back in the 70s in Latin America even. But in the East European context, from the kind of 80s onwards, it was designed to, like, how do you get an economy from being a planned economy to being a market-based one? And there are gradual ways of doing this. These have been tried in a number of countries, including, you know, Vietnam, to some extent, although it's a complicated case, China. But in a lot of Eastern Europe, this was done, you know, not exactly overnight, but incredibly rapidly on the ground. I mean, the argument for it was, this is going to be a rough transition, whatever happens, and it's better to do it all in one go and just force things in that direction. The problem with this was that it just generated tremendous, tremendous suffering. I mean, just to give you one example of this, there were monetary reforms, you know, reforms to the currency, which rendered people's savings just totally worthless overnight. And at the same time as this, the lifting of price controls, right? That's one of the big shock therapy measures that came in on New Year's Day 1992 after the fall of the Soviet Union. Excuse me, actually it wasn't New Year's Day, it was later in January, but there was a freeing of prices at the same time, and that just lets loose inflation, and meanwhile people have money that is worth less and less and less, but food is costing more and more and more. So you see that this is going to be, in the short term, a very dramatic and painful transformation. And so that, yeah, shock therapy refers to that complex of things.
So it sounds like there were a lot of losers when it comes to this transformation. Were there any winners? Did anyone come out on top? Not with regards to the West, but I mean within Russia.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, one of the interesting sort of processes that happened in Russia was the sudden emergence of all kinds of new social categories, if you like. And billionaires is one of them, right? This was, you know, there were people who were prosperous within the Soviet system, well connected, who had, you know, nicer cars than everybody else, a better apartment. But generally speaking, just the scale of inequalities that we have in the West was not present, and certainly not present in financial terms. And what happens in the 90s is just a sudden creation of massive inequalities of wealth. And that there are a number of winners in Russia, but one striking feature of it is that there aren't that many of them. It's very, very concentrated. But the ones who do well do extremely well, right? So, I mean, there was this idea in sort of 1991 or maybe slightly earlier among the kind of Russian advocates for free market reform that they were going to have some what they called a kind of popular capitalism where everyone is a shareholder in the national economy. And in practice, that is not what happened. What you ended up having was a mass of, you know, more impoverished people with a handful of incredibly wealthy tycoons. And by the middle of the 1990s, these people started to have a public profile and started to aspire to a political role. And that's where the term oligarch first appeared in Russia, at least referring to this handful of people who'd made their money through various kinds of mostly crooked privatization deals, and they become kind of really important figures on the national stage.
Now, how does Putin rise to power in all of this?
Yeah, so Putin, he's not especially visible through most of the 1990s. He's working in the city administration in St. Petersburg in the first half of the decade. And then in 1996, his boss, who the mayor of St. Petersburg, loses his re-election bid. So Putin is then out of a job in 1996. But through connections from his former job, he gets a new gig in Moscow working for the presidential administration, right? And he is working in a variety of roles for a couple of years, but partly, for example, in a very sensitive position dealing with the presidential property portfolio. Now, in the Russian case, this includes, you know, obviously managing a lot of buildings in Moscow, etc., in a normal way, but it also includes knowledge of Boris Yeltsin's, you know, ownership of villas in Switzerland, etc. So this is a very sensitive role, and so Putin establishes himself as a man who can get things done quietly and is very loyal. And I think this is one thing that people really have to realize about Putin is that he got where he did by being very personally loyal to his superiors. This is an important thing in terms of the chain of command in Russia, but also the fact that personal loyalties count for much more than, say, the law. So Yeltsin sees him as this quiet, not very charismatic, professional person who gets things done. And then in the kind of toward the end of the 90s, Putin moves very quickly up the ladder. You know, he's appointed to a series of more important roles, but he doesn't, in each of them, he's promoted very quickly higher up. And this is how you get a situation where in August 1999, Putin is suddenly made prime minister. And up until that point, most Russians had never heard of this guy, right? He was not a very prominent minister. He was Minister of State Security for about a year, I think, if I'm not wrong. Didn't have much time to leave a mark on that, and certainly didn't have a high public profile. So he is this sort of gray, fairly colorless, you know, bureaucratic type who's suddenly prime minister, and most Russians have never heard of him. And I think the important thing to bear in mind, again, as I mentioned, that he has proved his loyalty to Yeltsin. And that is the key factor in his rise to power, because one of the reasons he's appointed prime minister and eventually he becomes the successor to Yeltsin is that he will guarantee Yeltsin immunity from prosecution, right? Putin becomes prime minister at the end of a period where Russia has had something like five prime ministers in the space of a year and a half. There's a lot going on in that period, which we don't need to get into, a lot of genuine political turbulence, economic turbulence in Russia. But I maintain that the main factor here is that Yeltsin is looking for a successor who will protect him from prosecution. And a lot of people keep saying no, or they don't look like a safe pair of hands. And the thing about Putin, for as far as Yeltsin is concerned, is that this man is a safe pair of hands, right? And sure enough, New Year's Eve 1999, Yeltsin resigns as president and makes Putin acting president. The important thing about this is that it makes Putin acting president before he runs for the actual presidency in that spring. So there's this weird feature where this guy no one had heard of a few months before is suddenly president of the country, and an incumbent going into an election for this job, which he already has. It's a very confusing setup. It just underlines the whole way in which this process was a kind of coronation rather than an actual democratic procedure. And the first thing the first thing Putin does on becoming acting president is to sign a decree guaranteeing Yeltsin immunity. And for me, I think that transition from Yeltsin to Putin and the fact that it involves this guarantee of immunity really, I think, gives you a key to understanding this whole system and the continuity between these two phases. I think the fact that the reason the handover happened was to guarantee immunity for Yeltsin really says a lot about the nature of this system and how little it has to do with actual democracy.
You know, another thing I wanted to delve into is I think there's a lot of focus on Russia and its relationship to foreign policy, especially after the Ukraine crisis and the annexation of Crimea in 2013 and 2014. But something that I think gets sort of under-discussed in some ways is Russia after 91 is extremely weak, right? And it leaves a door open for the US and NATO to sort of do what they want globally. And I'm curious, what role does that have, not just in Putin's thought, but also in how Russia reacted to the US in the years following the fall of the Soviet Union?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think this is a really important factor, both within Russia and outside it. And again, this is one where I think the standard presentation that we're given about this in the media is, I think, upside down. That there is this general idea that the world was, you know, going along perfectly fine, and then along comes Putin and decides to restore the Cold War and, you know, promote this sort of aggressive Russian agenda in Eastern Europe, and then he decides to meddle in elections, et cetera, you know the drill. But I think that there's something that picture really just totally misses out on is the fact that the whole kind of global situation since the end of the Cold War has been really shaped by the massive dominance of the US over every other power, right? And this just means that the US can impose its strategic designs on the rest of the world without really getting any pushback. And that is really what has happened to Russia, is that, you know, and actually all of these documents are now publicly available. I mean, the discussions where Gorbachev, this is, I think, as late as 1990, if I'm not mistaken, he has conversations with various Western foreign ministers and says, look, if I withdraw everything from, at this point, the Soviets had already withdrawn a lot of their troops from Eastern Europe, but he's seeking guarantees that NATO will not expand. And a number of different Western leaders, certainly the British Prime Minister, I think the US Secretary of State also says it, the French President says it to him too, says, we guarantee NATO will not expand. This is something that most Western analysts have dismissed and said, no such promise was made, but we now have it on record that this promise was made and then totally broken. And this is something the Russians are, you know, have repeatedly complained about. And I'm not saying this in order to kind of, you know, try and legitimize the complaint. That's not my concern. But I think it just in order to understand the framework within which all of the discussions everyone has been having about Russian foreign policy over the past several years, it's just been much more profoundly shaped by Western dominance than people realize. And I think that's especially important because I think we really need to understand a lot of Russia's more aggressive behaviors as a response to their own weakness, right? You mentioned Russia being weak after 1991, and that's absolutely true. After 2000, there's a long period of high oil prices and Russia can sort of regain some of its previous capacity, but it's still a much, much weaker state, both militarily and strategically, than the Soviet Union ever was. And it really is not in a position to present any real challenge to US policy globally and even in Eastern Europe. And so a lot of what we see, a lot of what the Western media sees as aggressive Russian moves, you have to see as an attempt to really push back hard because they don't really have any other means of opposing this.
I was going to add in that regard, what I've often said to people in regards to Russia after the Soviet Union, I try to think in terms of this is a weakened nation state that it's wounded. It's like a wounded dog. And, you know, the U.S. is expanding operations globally through NATO. And I think Russia became resentful of that. So it's not a surprise to me that a figure like Putin comes along and is able to sort of work his magic with these feelings of Russian national pride. You know, we can be a strong nation again.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really important part of Putin's survival in power and the continuation of his rule is that he is perceived as having restored Russia's national dignity, if you like. A lot of people do see it that way in Russia.
He's very popular in the polls still, correct?
Yeah, I think lately less popular than he was before, but still, I think his ratings are certainly better than most Western leaders. I think, as far as I know, the latest ones, the approval rating was something in the high 50s, which is low for him. I mean, most of his time in power, even since, you know, I don't know, 2000, mostly he's been over 70%, I think. So dipping below 60 is a sign of trouble for him, but for any other ruler would be impressive. I mean, I guess the other thing I would say, though, that's maybe worth pointing out is that even though Putin bills himself as the restorer of Russian national pride, etc., and plays on these sort of Russian patriotic sentiments, for a long time, he is not doing this in opposition to the West, right? That he's actually trying to do this and trying to combine it with a desire to join with the West in some form. I mean, you know, this is mentioned in various people's accounts, and it's in my book as well, that in the year 2000, Bill Clinton meets with Putin, and Putin asks him about joining NATO. Right? I mean, this is very hard to imagine now that Russia would join NATO, but this was a serious aspiration for a while. And repeatedly through the 2000s, the Russians are trying to make some kind of trade deal with the EU. They're also trying to, you know, propose some kind of new strategic architecture in which Russia and NATO and the US can be kind of some kind of joint partners, etc. And really, this impulse to join with the West, it lasts a lot longer than people realize. I think there is this tendency to think, oh, you know, Russia and the West have been on a collision course really since Putin took power, or at least, you know, since, I don't know, you can pick like 2008, maybe the Russian-Georgian war and the clashes over that. But actually that impulse really carried on through until, I would argue, maybe even the Ukraine crisis was the thing that broke it. But for the longest time, Putin still believed that some kind of combination of Russia's national interests and cooperation with the West was possible. So I think we don't want to, like, the current situation is obviously there's a lot of animosity, but I don't think we want to project that too far back in the past. I think that it didn't necessarily have to turn out that way.
One thing that I found very irksome when discussing Putin and the geopolitics of Russia in recent times is I think there's a lot of paranoia about Putin and about Russia. And I keep seeing certain pundits want to bring up this very obscure, in my view, sort of wacky figure known as Alexander Dugin, and claim that Dugin is sort of masterminding Putin, and that he sort of has these megalomaniacal designs for Russia. And I find it very bizarre, very cartoonish, especially since Dugin himself is, you know, as far as I understand it, a rather disgraced academic in Russia. But I find it interesting that there's this idea that Russia, through characters like Putin or Dugin, have designs to almost take over the world. What, though, is the reality? What does Russia want geopolitically? Because I don't think it's world domination.
No. I mean, I think they don't have the, I mean, they certainly don't have the capacity, but also I don't think they have the interest. I think that's really not, I mean, yeah, as you say, there are all these kind of very paranoid fantasies about, well, Russia wants to bring down the West or polish off democracy or, you know, whatever it is. And I think, to be honest, that's not their concern. What they would like is, I think, I mean, and again, I say this as a critic of the Russian government, so this is not something I would support at all. But if you like, I think what they would like is some version of like the Monroe Doctrine for Eurasia, right? That Russia has a legitimate set of interests that the West will respect, and that includes Russian influence over the countries that it borders, right?
In other words, they want NATO to back off.
They want NATO to back off. And they want, I mean, this is an interesting, you know, it's striking how often Russia refers to international law. Now, this is not because the Putin government or any Russian government has been an especially great fan of legality, but international law is an instrument, is an area in which, in theory, states are supposed to be treated as equals, right? Sovereign states are formally equal in international law, and therefore they should be treat each other as peers. And I think what Russia always wants is to be treated as a peer. I think one of the most devastating things that a US leader could say was said, could say about Russia was said by President Obama, I think, in 2014, when he said, Russia just going to be, I think Russia is a regional power, right? Rather than a global power. And I think what the Russians have is really they would like some kind of sort of global, new global kind of settlement in which their interests are respected by the other major powers, and their importance as a major player is acknowledged. And I think this is one of the interesting things. Rather, one of the more plausible explanations for me of a lot of Russia's moves in the last few years in foreign policy is not that they have designs to undermine the West or democracy, but actually, I mean, the main example of this is the Russian intervention in Syria in support of the Assad government. I mean, I think they're not deeply committed to Assad, and they're not deeply committed to the support of, you know, autocratic murderous regimes per se. I think actually in Syria, their move was really to demonstrate to the West that they could really shift the balance of the situation there and change the course of the war, and therefore that Russia is a major player in Middle East affairs whose interests need to be taken into account. And a lot of what Russia does, again, there's no, you know, there's no commercial motivation for Russia in supporting Assad. There's not even any great commercial motivation in Russia supporting Iran. And certainly no ideological motivation, but it's really to demonstrate to the rest of the world, and specifically NATO and the US, that Russia is a power that needs to be taken into account, if you like. That, I guess if you wanted a one-line summary of what Russia wants, it's that, yeah, it wants to be taken into account.
There were just two more things I wanted to cover very briefly, if you had the time. The first is your criticisms that you mentioned earlier of Putin. You mentioned that you are not a supporter of Putin or the current Russian government. What do you think the main criticisms you would make are?
the main criticisms I would make. Oh, I have so many. I mean, I'm on record from early on in the Putin administration as a critic of his war on Chechnya, which is really what got him to the presidency, right? He launched what I consider, the war on a counterinsurgency on Chechnya that he called an anti-terrorist operation, and that was really, a very brutal full-scale war on an entire people that involved a number of war crimes being committed on a civilian against the civilian population. So I think that's, number one at the origin of his regime is this really criminal war against the civilian population. And that's right at the beginning. Since then, I think there's a lot of other criticism one could make of the conduct of the regime. Its corruption certainly is very strong. A lot of other terrible things it does on a daily basis. But I think the main one I would say is that this is a government that is deeply committed to the principles of the enrichment and power of an elite class at the expense of the rest of the population. And it will do anything to preserve that power, and it will dress it up in whatever ideological garb it feels is useful. So it's a very, it's not an especially ideological regime. It's very adaptable. It's gone through several different changes of clothes, if you like. But I think really its denial of both, democratic will, and simultaneously and related to that, its denial of a decent living to its population, I would say are the main criticisms I would have.
And I guess before closing out, my understanding is 2024, we will actually be seeing a Russia without Putin.
Well, I mean, actually, this is the question of the day, because there is so this is a complicated, maybe a long-winded answer, but in January, Putin proposed or raised this idea that they would modify the constitution, and one of the things that it would do was limit all future presidents to 2 terms in total. So no one could do what Putin did, be president for 2 terms, leave, and then come back again. It would also shift a lot more power to the prime minister, and it would shift more power to a range of other state bodies. So what this looked like back in January was, oh, Putin is preparing to move chairs in 2024 and to leave the presidency being a much less powerful office. So this could be both a very opaque move to make the power structure more diffuse, but it could also be a sort of democratic move in that the parliament would then have a lot more power and the prime minister would have more power, right? So in January, this is what this looked like. It looked like, oh, maybe Putin, not only maybe is Putin leaving in 2024, but the whole Russian political system is going to look different as well. It won't be just Putin's replaced by some other guy. Then in March, a new version of this amendment is put forward saying, oh, what we would like to do is allow Putin, essentially there's a new twist to the amendment that allows Putin to stand again for 2 more presidential terms, right? Because there's a new constitution, everyone's term limits get reset. This is called the resetting to zero. So Putin would be allowed under the new constitution to run for 2 more terms, which would keep him in power to 2036, right? These are now 6-year terms. So 2024, Putin could run again, and he would stay there for 2 more terms. And so at that point, so in January, if it looked like Putin might leave, by March, when this amendment is proposed, it looks like, oh, actually Putin's going to stay forever. And so this new referendum, it got delayed because of the pandemic. And then voting was held on it partly remotely, partly in person in Russia in the past week. And the results were announced, I guess, 1st of July, 2nd of July. And no surprise that this new constitution, these amendments to the constitution were passed overwhelmingly, something like 78% yes. And generally speaking, most coverage of this in the West and a lot of coverage of it in Russia, the implication is, oh yes, Putin is definitely doing this in order to hold on to power until 2036. My interpretation of this is slightly different. I think I'm not the only one. I think various people have this idea that what Putin is doing is giving himself a range of options, and that the problem with that he faced before was that everyone was aware that in 2024 he would be leaving office. And so he had there's a weird sense in which even now, you know, in 2020, he was already not exactly a lame duck, but the Russian elite was already maneuvering and seeing who would be the successor. And so what his constitutional maneuvers that he was doing were to try and avoid that scenario of effectively becoming a lame duck. And so these new changes, even if they do raise the possibility of him staying until 2036, you know, permanent Putin, that's certainly possible. That's one of the scenarios. But I would not discount another scenario where he could actually just walk off at any point. The point is really that he has the power to do that and hand over the system to someone who's going to be less powerful than he is now, right? So yeah, that's a long, convoluted answer. But I guess in theory, whilst everyone is now talking about Putin staying there for life, I think actually he's keeping his options open in order to leave on his own schedule rather than in line with the end of one or other presidential term.
In that case, why, in your opinion, should we start thinking of a Russia beyond the horizon of Putin? And also, maybe you could answer this first really briefly, because it just popped into my head, was in some ways, is Putin, if not our Frankenstein monster, sort of a child of some of the things the US has done?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. No, I would say that actually, you know, the Western role in propping up Yeltsin and in propping up the project of capitalist transformation in Russia at the expense of democracy in the 1990s, that has been very important in terms of laying down a set of principles according to which Russia is governed. And Putin has certainly learned from that. He knows what's important and is not democracy, put it that way. I think in terms of thinking about Russia beyond Putin, I guess one analogy that often comes to mind, but this may be a bit sort of far-fetched for people, but, you know, during the Cold War, and especially, you know, in the high period of the Cold War in the 50s and 60s, most understandings of the Soviet Union were framed through this idea of totalitarianism, right? There is this all-powerful state. It tells people what to do. It's all-powerful. The ordinary citizens are just sort of passive drones and they can't really do anything about it. This was the dominant perception of the Soviet Union. People still use this term in journalism. You see this in the New York Times all the time about, oh, is Putin bringing back totalitarianism? But, you know, this is just ideology. And actually, many, many years after, it took until the sort of 70s when a lot of Western scholars could go to Russia and study and interview people and really do proper scholarship. And they realized, oh, this whole totalitarian paradigm for understanding the Soviet Union is junk. That actually, this is a complex society that you can't just explain it as being a top-down command structure and all the population obeys. That's just nonsense. And that's not how a real country works. And you need some more complicated way of understanding it that is not focused on the Kremlin, right? It took 20 or 30 years for the West to really understand how wrong they had been. So in my head, like part of my effort in this book is to say, I want to save you all time, right? You're going to spend years going on about Putin, and the longer he stays there, the more you're going to focus on him, and you're going to get further and further away from any real understanding of how Russia works, so that if and when he actually leaves the scene, you need to be in a better place to understand what kind of country you're looking at. And the more you focus on Putin, and the more you use this kind of really reheated kind of totalitarian paradigm for understanding Russia, the less well you'll understand the country as and when it emerges from that.
Well, Tony Wood, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. Let my listeners know how they can get hold of your book, Russia Without Putin, Money, Power, and the Myths of the New Cold War.
Oh, yeah, I'd be glad to. Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. I would recommend you get it through your local bookseller. I would also request you don't buy through Amazon if at all possible. It's also available direct from my publishers, Verso Books. So you can get it at versobooks.com. That's VersoBooks.com. And actually often they will give you the ebook and paperback as a package. So you don't even have to wait for it to arrive in the mail before you start reading.
And thank you again, Tony Wood, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Tony Wood, author of Russia Without Putin, Money, Power, and the Myths of the New Cold War. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/ParallaxViews. A shout out to my $10 tier on Patreon, producers credit to Mark, Amelia, and Martin. Thank you so much. And thank you to the rest of my Patreon supporters for making this show possible. So if you enjoy the program, please consider joining those Patreon supporters by throwing me some cash at patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.